This Week in Radio Tech, episode 245, is brought to you by Lavo and the new Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the radio console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. By the Telos HX6 talk show system, six lines and two advanced hybrids deliver great calls at a popular price. And by the new Axia Fusion AOIP mixing console, packed with features and capabilities refined from over a decade's worth of IP audio experience. Lots of questions about the FCC's net neutrality rules under Title II, like when is the public internet actually private? Plus, Chris Tobin lays a foundation for the value of maintenance, and Kevin Kidd joins us to help stop copper thieves. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. I'm glad you're here. Boy, we're just happy to be doing the show. We talk about everything radio, audio, RF, and some really interesting subjects today that are kind of ancillary. We're talking about how not to get ripped off by either an engineer, your own stupidity, or thieves. Yes, thieves. Well, that's coming up. Our show is brought to you today by the folks at Lavo and Telos and Axia. We'll tell you about the sponsors as we move along today. Hey, as usual, joining us on the show is our favorite engineer in Manhattan, the best-dressed engineer in radio. It's Chris Tobin. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
Hello, Kirk. Hello, everyone. I'm doing well, despite the single-digit temperatures coming this evening. So it's going to be good.
Did you guys get a lot of snow in New York in the past few days?
No. Here in Manhattan, it was dusting. Outside, the Manhattan itself, the boroughs, Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island, Bronx, got significant snowfall. New Jersey, Long Island, Westchester. But yeah, Manhattan itself, no. It was interesting. It just like passed over us.
You have that protective bubble, that the Mayor Blasio bubble.
Please, no. There's no bubble. Even the groundhog's not safe.
I was in Cleveland early part of this week, and I flew in Sunday afternoon, and snow, yeah. I mean, it wasn't really deep, but it was, you know, the usual traffic snarls and people getting to work late on Monday morning. Beautiful, though. I was staying in the hotel across from the cathedral in downtown Cleveland, and just absolutely gorgeous snow all over the cathedral. And yeah, it's pretty when you don't have to deal with it. Just look out the window at it, right? Yeah. Hey, a few things in the news this week. Net neutrality, we have some view of the proposal, a summary of the proposed rules from Chairman Wheeler. I'm sure that'll make news when they vote on it, which will be late in February. They're going to vote the full FCC board will vote on the proposed rules, basically making your internet service provider into where it's governed by Title II of the Communications Act. So we'll see how that works out. Chairman Wheeler promises to ignore the enforcement of certain provisions in the Communications Act.
Okay.
So, yeah, that'll be interesting. Don't worry about those rules. We're not going to enforce all that. Just the stuff that we unless we change our mind.
Well, you know, it's interesting with that whole net neutrality BS, because that's what it really is. There are already laws on the books for antitrust and for consumer protection for the stuff they claim this is going to help prevent or at least provide. Because remember, if you're really, really up on utilities and how they function, where they come and go, just remember your electric bill, your phone bill, your water bill, and a few other municipalities that you have to pay for.
Okay. I You know, of course, most people have exactly one place from which they can buy their water. And that's how it is, you know, here at my house.
It's true.
And I realize stuff gets more expensive over time, and I realize stuff costs money. But do you know, at my house here in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm pretty happy with the things I have to buy here in Nashville, like taxes, property taxes, not so high here in Nashville, not terrible. I couldn't afford taxes up in your part of the world. Oh, my goodness. But my water bill here in Nashville, it's water and sewer together, right? So they got you coming and going. It's like typically it's about $110 a month for water. And that's just, to me, it's just inconceivably amazingly high. Does that seem high to you?
Yeah. Well, you have to look at, see how they, you know, how they justify all the costs and who gets paid for what. You know, I just was watching the other day the New York City Council channel, and it was interesting to discover what the city, you know, what do you call it? Citizens pay for in city services, and who gets paid and why and how. And it's just, it's scary. I mean, you know, you don't even get an 80 hours day's worth of work out of people anymore. And you know, the costs of what they do and why it costs so much is just, it just doesn't, you know, doesn't track. If you're a private business or a publicly traded business, you'd be out of business if you followed some of these municipalities and the way they, you know, justify the finances.
Hey, Kirk, that's how much I pay for my my water and sewer.
Oh, really? About 110 a month?
About 110, 120 a month.
Wow. Wow. That's just, that's amazing. Oh, well. It's decently clean water here. That's pretty, not bad in New York either. Hey, on the net neutrality thing, I'm sure we'll have some stuff to say, but I'm sure we'll also wait until after it passes and we find out some or after it passes or doesn't pass, and we'll find out more about it. But I just want to say that I've always felt like that the issue of the benefits that people want to get out of net neutrality is not an issue for the FCC to handle. It is instead, if you want to put it under the auspices of some controlling body, it's a Department of Commerce issue. It's a fair trade. It's a consumer thing. If I pay for 50 megabits a second download and 12 megabits a second upload, which is what I pay for on Comcast, I should get that on a statistically reasonable basis. You know, anytime I want to try it, I should get 50 megabits to the edge of Comcast network and beyond. In other words, put a server at the other side of their peer, at the output of their peering, not in their network, but at the spigot out. And if I get that speed and it's not hindered, then Comcast has done their job. And make that, I mean, doesn't mean everybody can test at the same time. I get that. There's not enough gym equipment for every member of the gym to work out at the same time. I get that. But if on some statistically significant basis, like, you know, 98.2% of the time I get what I pay for, then that should be okay. And there ought to be enough bandwidth at the peering points that I get that all the way through to the port, to the other port on the peering point. Now, and that's what Comcast is responsible for. If Cogent hasn't provided enough connectivity to Comcast at that peering point, well, that's Cogent's fault. And I can't, you know, I can't expect, you know, Comcast to solve that. But that's my opinion. I think it's more of a consumer affairs problem.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. That's what I'm saying. There are already laws in place, rules, regulations for that. But if you don't treat it that way, if you don't, you know, go after the business that's not providing you the service you're paying for, then this is what you get. You get people talking about net neutrality, which is going to be a mess. And just like you said, you know, Comcast to the peering point is where that's where the bottleneck is. That's where all the issues are. And interestingly enough, this week I had to go to my Time Warner cable office because, you know, you can't just send the stuff back to them in the mail. You got to go there. I asked the person, because they were asking me, am I satisfied with my internet service that they provide? And I was like, well, define satisfied. And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, well, I'm not certain if I'm really getting my up and download speeds. Well, you have this, you have that. I said, right, but to where, which part of your network does it go to? Is it just to the connection in the building, to the DOCSIS point, to the network server inside your network? Or does it actually go to the end where you hand off to the other part of the internet? I didn't even say peering or anything.
Yeah.
And the person just looked at me like, well, I said, see, if you can't answer that question while you're trying to take my money, I'm concerned. Yeah. I don't think you really understand what's going on. They were charging me for a digital television adapter, and I said, look, I'm watching, you know, stuff. You told me it was for free. Now all of a sudden I'm getting a bill that's in the mail for 99 cents a month so I can watch basic cable. I was like, doesn't make any sense. You told me free for a year. Now all of a sudden it's not free. And she goes, oh, well, our promotions are always 12 months. I was like, really? So what does this promotion say? Because it doesn't say 12 months only. So eventually I got them to take it back, and I'm not paying for it. But that's the problem. So now that situation right there, my little encounter, is that an FCC-regulated encounter, or would that be a Department of Commerce or Consumer Affairs? That would be Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs.
I hear
maybe I'm simplifying
stories.
It. I don't know, but that's my gut feeling.
Yeah. I hear horror stories of people. I mean, there are people who just hate Comcast and hate whoever their provider is. Okay, I haven't had that same hateful experience, but I can understand that you might. Maybe I'm very lucky here in Nashville. We have if you have to go into a Comcast office here, it's always a dismal experience. Or dealing with them on the phone is fairly dismal. But, you know, if you don't have to deal with them, I get great service, and my speeds keep going up, and my bill doesn't really get much higher. And well, I guess my point is this: Comcast. I asked an installer came to my house a few years ago. I said, I've noticed that I'm buying 50 megabits, and I always get like 52, 53 down. And I think I'm paying for 10 megabits. Maybe I was paying for 8 megabits up, and I was always getting 10, 11, 11 and a half megabits up. So I'm always getting, at least in your network, to a server, you know, no matter where it is on the Comcast, I'm always getting a little bit more than I'm paying for. What's up with that? And I'm thankful. And he said, we got sick and tired of people complaining that I'm paying for 10 megabits, I'm only getting 8.3. You know, why create that angst with your customers? Just give them, you know, 8% more than they're paying for all the time, at least within your network. And the peering points are a little different issue, but give people a bit more than and they're not going to complain. And I think now I guess I wish Comcast would do that with other parts of their service. I wish they'd apply that same thinking to other places. And I wish AT&T and Sprint and everybody else would apply that same kind of thinking. Give the customer at least what they're paying for, so they can't just sit there and grouch and bitch and bellyache because they're not getting the last, you know, 5% of the speed that they're paying for. Do you have a thought about that, Chris?
Absolutely. So basically what you're saying is that installer who's an employee of Comcast, who represents Comcast as far as you're concerned in your eyes, actually admitted that they weren't providing the proper service or the level of service expected by the payments that were being made. So they were tired of people complaining about not getting what they were paying for, so they decided to add an extra 10% just to get them to stop complaining.
That's what it sounded like to me. Now, I don't know if he was speaking, an official position, but that was his heartfelt impression, and maybe what his boss told him. You know, why make an acute angle every time you deal with somebody who's a little bit savvy and says, I'm not getting the speed I'm paying for? Instead of provisioning it for 10 and you end up eking out 9.8 out of it, provision it for 12 megabits and they get 10 plus all the time.
Right. So what you're basically asking them to do is something that makes common sense, to apply common sense, and it doesn't. It's just like what I experienced this week with the digital terminal adapter that allows you to get basic service because of the digital conversion that was lobbied by the industry. So the FCC said to everybody, you can no longer have unencrypted or, you know, QAM modulated cable. Mm-hmm. They want to charge you $1 per box per month just to connect so you can get the decoded basic service, which is literally like five channels.
Right.
So
right.
Why would you go to the trouble of all that back office stuff for a 99-cent incident? And then when somebody challenges it like I did, they say, we'll change it. We won't charge you for it. I'm like, so why couldn't you do that in the beginning?
These are the things
that consumer affairs departments and public utility commissions, that's what their job is. That's what they have to be told about from people like us. You don't do net neutrality because you think it's a nice thing because the guys at the cable industry need some kind of lobbying to protect them. Because that's basically what it is. It's protection money. Because I know for a fact in New York City, there are several dozen buildings that can't get a competing internet service because for some reason, the internet competing service says it's not worth their trouble. Hmm. I'm like, you're a privately funded company. You're actually publicly traded. So if I was a shareholder, you're telling me you're turning away business, but your dividends haven't gone up and your share value hasn't gone up. What's going on?
Yeah.
These are things, that's where you need to get in there, and the Commerce Department, Consumer Affairs, and all those laws are on the books. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's out that's already there. That's why I'm only saying this because I have no problem with the internet stuff. I like the way it's working. I like the fact that competition is getting people ticked off, okay? That's good. But we're just letting people, you know, I said to somebody the other day, at the rate we're going with net neutrality, just put up a slate of lemmings going off a cliff, okay? Because that's basically what we're doing. Tom Wheeler, FCC commissioner, chairman, whatever you want to call him, politically appointed person, came out of which industry? Oh, cable.
Cable. Mm-hmm.
Whose interest do you think he has at heart? Oh, please don't tell me he's being, you know, very, very, you know, nonpartisan, whatever you want to call it. I mean, come on. Read some of this stuff and it's like, whoa. And just like you pointed out, you're doing great. Matter of fact, didn't you say your service improved when they found out Google was coming to town?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And I fully expect it to get even better before Google gets here. It's still 4 or 5 years before Google, you know, gets fiber around Nashville.
But that's what I'm saying. I know I have family members who have Cablevision, and the price has gone up almost 200%. Service hasn't changed any. Nothing's changed. They're being told they have to pay more, so they've canceled it. And then they say, well, we want to go somewhere else. Sorry, the franchise licensing doesn't permit anybody else into the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So Cablevision has a lock on the neighbors.
Right. And yeah, I tell you what, let's talk about that just a bit more. I know we got off on the subject, but we got a couple more things to say about it before we jump into the value of maintenance. And our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavo, L-A-W-O, pronounced Lavo. It is a company that makes consoles, audio consoles and routing systems. Lavo is a German company, and they make, you know, they're known for making great, big, huge, enormous audio consoles for television and live sound and sports trucks and things like that. But they also make a line of consoles for radio stations. It's their Crystal line of consoles. And one of their newest products is called the Crystal Clear. This is a virtual radio mixing console. It uses a DSP-based mixing engine that also has the inputs and outputs. That's a one-rack unit box that goes in the rack. But to control it, well, you could plug a Crystal console surface into it over a network. It works over Ethernet. Or you can run a computer with this Crystal Clear software running on it. And this gives you a console that is virtual. It's running on a PC. It's actually a Windows 8 operating system, and it's actually an app. And they've chosen to use a computer that has a multi-touch touchscreen interface. So this is very cool. You get 8 faders on the surface. You get a total, I think, of 24 possible inputs on the console. Those are physical inputs. The DSP engine also can speak Ravenna and AES-67. So you can go with audio over IP to other devices that are on your network. Means you could talk to other competing AOIP systems as long as they can produce and receive an AES-67 stream or a Ravenna stream. And so it's compatible. It's small. It's, you know, a one-rack unit box that has all the local I.O., including a couple of mic inputs, some analog, some AES, and then some analog and AES outputs as well, and that AOIP connection for Ravenna. Or AES-67. Dual power supplies are available, so you get some redundancy there. And you know what? If you need to, for some reason, if you need to reboot the computer that's running the Surface, no problem. You just reboot it. The engine just sits there and keeps doing what it was doing. If you were mixing, you know, 3 automation sources together at the same time, it continue to do that. If you need to pull that Crystal Clear Surface, that computer out, replace it with another one. You can do that. You can even control it with a Crystal Clear Surface that is a bit farther away. I'm not sure if it if it can be around the world, but certainly through VPN you could do this as well. So it's just some data going back and forth between the Surface and the DSP engine. The folks at Lavo have really latched onto this idea of controlling consoles over distance, over a network, and giving you this virtual work surface, the Crystal Clear. Of course, it has all the usual things you'd find in a console: Program 1, Program 2, Preview Channel, Scene Saving, and Easy Recall. One of the cool things, though, is when you press a button on the virtual surface, it's very context sensitive. If you're wanting to deal with the options button for a microphone, it doesn't show you options that aren't available for a microphone. It shows you the things that have to do with what you're touching. So that's another benefit. There's a lot less confusion, and you really get to the point when you deal with any option on this console. Check it out if you would. It's on the web at Lavo. That's Lavo.com. The founder, Philip Lavo, has really done a great job of moving this product forward and trying to meet the needs of broadcasters and give them something interesting and new and beneficial to work with. Lavo.com, look for radio products and the Crystal Clear audio console. And we thank them for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, and we were just finishing up, Chris Tobin, about some net neutrality. And, you know, broadcasters are a bit concerned about this. And I think the Tom Wheeler's proposal tries to separate, and I don't know how this works practically. You know, some people feel like, oh, we don't want fast lanes. We don't want a big company to pay for preferential treatment. Well, okay. And I hope they're talking about the publicly accessible internet, the internet that we know of when we, you know, sit down at a computer, hook to the internet and go to Google or Yahoo or ESPN or something, or GFQ Live. You know, we hope we're talking about that internet, because, you know, there's all kinds of data connectivity provided by internet providers, and we want that prioritized. Voice over IP, Skype packets like we're using now. If CBS television is doing a sports remote and they're sending three cameras of HD video back to some, you know, switching center in New York, they would love to pay for some prioritization. Is that the public internet and it won't be available, or is that a separate data service that is a part, run on the same switches, perhaps run perhaps even over the same fibers, but are we going to be able to pay for the things we want to do to make the things we want to do reliable? Any idea, Chris?
Sure you can. Yeah, sure you can. You can do it right now. What we're
you can do it now, but after net neutrality,
you won't be able to. Well, after net neutrality, it's going to be a whole new game.
Well, there is some question. I read the summary of Wheeler's proposal, and it did appear to separate the public internet that most people, that when you type google.com, that's where you go. You're going through that versus, hey, I want to buy this data service from you, Comcast. Can you provide it for me? Will that be prioritizable?
Well, this is what makes me laugh. Right now we're on I'll call it the consumer retail internet connection. And
yeah.
You use it. And there are restrictions on this account that I have, because if I wanted to put a server up, I guarantee you within short order, I'd be told that I violated my terms of service. But if I'm a business, and we'll use your example, the CBS television wants to do the Democratic or Republican political convention, say from Chicago back to New York or from Brooklyn back to Manhattan, basically you have a choice. You can either purchase a business link, MPLS, from any carrier, or you can try and cheat and just simply order a local, you know, retail internet drop, a cable modem, and hope for the best. Those are your choices. But net neutrality now says, guess what? It's on the onus is going to be on the carrier to dictate what exactly is public and private. Because right now, on my retail consumer connection, if I choose, I can do a VPN tunnel to my office and get onto my business internet. Yeah. So now what do you call that? What have I done? Have I violated the terms of service? Have I bypassed something? Have I cheated Comcast, or in this case, Time Warner Cable, out of something because I'm doing a VPN? They can't do anything in the middle? See, that's why I'm saying all this stuff is out there now. It's just a question of who's willing to look it up. Because you can go to a company called TowerStream. They'll be more than happy to give you a wireless local loop and whatever bandwidth you'd like to pay for. And it's professional, and they give you guaranteed quality of service if you want it. You can also go to Rainbow Broadband is another one. But everybody's got this thing in their head that they should be able to just go to a local carrier, get a cable modem in their office, and be able to do what they want, when technically it's, you know, it's consumer retail. So really, it's already there. But by doing this with the FCC, you're now sort of obfuscating the ability to really regulate, as you pointed out. How do I know which is public, which is private? If I'm a business, am I paying for business class, or am I paying for just retail? Because they were willing to put it in, and they just said, well, if you do anything beyond the retail approach, I'll just call it that. I mean, it's probably better. There's a better term. Then I can be hit with terms of service violation. And that opens up a whole other can of worms. Just like my LTE, 4G, Verizon, USB modem. Technically, it's just a consumer connection. If I start doing crazy stuff with it, they could technically tell me I'm violating terms of service.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, All I have to do is say, look, I'm going to do it for business. Then they say, well, for business, we give you this pricing. Why? Because that pricing guarantees you, we'll call it a fast lane, maybe, on that highway of other things.
And I, you know, as broadcasters,
I could be, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm totally wrong and I just don't get it. But I mean, if I'm going to look to do stuff and I know it's a specialty item, like you pointed out in the case of CBS TV carrying video across, or even if it's ABC or any network, you know, there are services out there. They can do it. I mean, they do most of the companies with their own private networks.
You're not wrong to ask the question, because it's not been addressed clearly. Or at all, perhaps. You're not wrong to ask, well, what does this do to any kind of preferential treatment that or violating my terms of service? Let me ask you this. You know, for companies like Telos, Comrex, and I'm sure others have talked to various wireless carriers and said, is there some way that a broadcaster who wants to run, let's say, an IP codec that's connected to a 4G USB modem, is there some way that we can pay you extra and get a little guarantee of some bandwidth? Like, let's say we're at a big sports venue and there's 20,000 people using their Verizon data plan. And here I am, and I'd like for my packets to make sure they get through so the broadcast can go on. And I'm willing to pay you something extra for that. It appears to me that there will be no opportunity for that to happen.
There is no opportunity for that to happen if they go in the course they're taking. But to do that example, I actually did propose that and talked to Verizon 5 years ago, working with a newsroom operation, because that's what we wanted to do. Because I discovered that the Verizon wireless network is not allowed to do business with the Verizon retail ISP landline DSL off to the other part of the world. That's because of regulations. But I did discover, talking with the Verizon folks, and I'm sure this is probably true for AT&T and anyone else. Matter of fact, I know it is for two other ISPs I talked to recently. If I chose, I can install a virtual private connection to their point of presence where their wireless modems come out of. So picture this. You have a wireless network. You say you're doing Super Bowl. So you're in Arizona. You call up Verizon or AT&T and say, guys, I want to install a VPC to your point of presence where you hand off from your wireless to the first pop, wherever, however they structure it, so I can get somewhat guaranteed connectivity. I know where I'm going and what can we do. Odds are they'd probably be willing to say, sure, we'll do that. And here's the cost. But nobody's ever talked about it. I've talked to several people over the last 2 years proposing that to a couple of companies, large companies, and they all looked at me like, well, you can't do that. I'm like, yes, you can. It's a real simple thing. You just have to be willing to pay for it. And nobody ever thought or even talked about it. I'm like, these are things that are out there. And I actually worked with the Department of Commerce last year, in the National Weather Service on a project. And I did exactly that with a local wireless ISP. And the guy was like, yeah, we never thought of it that way. Yeah, you could do that. We'll let you hand off. And we made it work. And for 5 months, we used half public internet and all the private connection back to make some things happen. Mm-hmm. And everyone sat there scratching their heads going, oh, wow, it actually worked. But if net neutrality goes the way I think it will go, I don't think I would be able to do that again. But if I can, it would probably cost me 500 times what it's worth because of the restrictions that will be put in place. Or the fact that the plausible deniability can be applied and the carriers can simply say, look, that's the law. That's the regulations. I have to charge you.
Like
they used to do with the old tariffs.
Yeah. Yeah. Did Comcast wittingly or unwittingly stoke the fires of the net neutrality advocacy crowd by their spat with Netflix a year ago, where, you know, they curtailed the bandwidth of Netflix, saying, pay us money. And I got frustrated with Netflix. I couldn't watch Netflix in HD. The pictures I was getting from Netflix were pretty crummy. And thank goodness I was only paying, I'm only paying $9 a month for it. So, but if I really, I was a little honked off. The public internet itself doesn't support quality of service tags right now anyway, and probably good that it doesn't. Everybody would, everybody who knew anything would put their DSCP a tag at some high value for everything. That wouldn't be right either. But, Comcast certainly had the ability to say, here's a big honking bunch of data from coming in from Netflix through Cogent, whoever the Netflix's ISP was. We're just going to curtail that. And Comcast had the ability to do that. They did it, and they honked off a bunch of people, consumers, by doing that. Did that stoke the fires?
Well, it created misdirection because, frankly, I'm paying for a service. I'm paying for an internet service from Time Warner Cable, and I expect to be able to connect to Netflix and get what I want. Mm-hmm. What right does Time Warner Cable have to disrupt my service from Netflix because they failed to meet my expectations through the contract I have with them? Because that's basically what they're doing. They have a deal They have a deal to hand off data to me, and whatever I do with it is what I do with it. And I chose to be a subscriber to Netflix. So therefore, their business plan should be, hey, we've got 1,200 people looking to do Netflix in this region. What do we need to do to ensure that our bandwidth meets their requests because they're doing this the business? Mm-hmm. And instead, what we get is the cable companies crying, oh my goodness, I don't know what to do. All these people want a service. Well, listen, either you're in the business of delivering data or you're in the business delivering content, and you can't have both and eat it, and, you know, have your cake and eat it too. So which is it? Netflix does business with Cogent. We'll use Cogent as an example. I'm not endorsing anything here. They do business with Cogent to get the tiering or the peering behind the scenes to get off to the various cable distribution centers. Then all of a sudden, the people taking it in say, well, wait a minute. This is not what we agreed to. It's like, well, yes, it is. It's not my fault. Your customers, and you have the largest group of customers, decide they want our service because we now provide programming they like House of Cards. Or the, you know, black is orange. And it's like, all of a sudden now there's a spike and they're not getting what they want. Same is true for Google, you know, searches. Why all of a sudden does a cable company say, sorry, you know, you're doing too much with Google and we don't like that? Really?
Hmm.
Maybe you should be talking to your back office people as to, did you plan this? Did you not see that this is growing and things are happening? And I really fault them because they're in the content business. Comcast, Universal, NBC. Mm-hmm. So it's not like as if you didn't know if there's something popular is going to be spiking the network.
Yeah.
You know, and the truth, same thing could be true for Super Bowl. You're going to tell me now if NFL decides to stream the Super Bowl and 1,200 people decide they want to watch it off their phones or their computer, tablets in their house, is Comcast going to have the right to say to NFL, hey, pay me more because tough bananas. You know, all of a sudden people want to use you instead of the TV. But wait a minute, but the TV is DOCSIS 3.0. So how do I know that the TV service you're providing me is not, I mean, you're not double dipping? Because I can tell you right now on Time Warner Cable, four times a day, my cable box for television constantly turns on, goes black and says, please wait. Not sure why. No one can tell me what's going on, but it seems to happen on a regular basis. And then when I'm watching certain Netflix services, it conveniently, every night at around 11:55 p.m. Eastern, the box resets.
Huh.
But only when I'm watching Netflix, because when I've done the same thing at the same time with other stuff, the box doesn't reset.
Yeah.
But I can't prove anything because according to the people I talk to, they have no record of the box doing these things. See, that's what I'm saying. That's why I'm a little annoyed at this net neutrality stuff and people are just like lemmings just running around. It's like, you can do a lot. And you know, like you pointed out, you know, it's Consumer Affairs, Department of Commerce. It's already there. But if nobody complains, then, you know, the guy's getting away with murder. We'll continue to do their thing.
Just give me what I paid for. It's
crazy, but that's what it is.
It's interesting how often peering is pointed to as a problem. Of course, peering requires two companies or multiple companies in the that have all built up some stuff, some cages in the same place to talk to each other. Okay, Comcast and Cogent, here, you're in the same room. You have to talk to each other. Have a conversation now. And if there's more data that you need to discuss than you have a mouth for, guess what? You got to bring in some more mouths. You got to bring in some more lawyers. You got to bring in some more people talking to each other. And so this is – and if there are – I've certainly read blog sites and reports showing the saturation of peering points. And, of course, to engineers, well, just – get some more bandwidth. I mean, run some more fiber and put some more cards in there and connect up to, you know, get more bandwidth and solve that problem. Now, what I'm a little fuzzy on is why is the cost involved with peering points and how things are charged for. And I do hear often enough that asymmetrical bandwidth apparently is a bad thing at peering point. I don't know why. Of course, in the world we live in, things are getting more asymmetrical as high bandwidth services are provided from a one-to-many basis. That is going to result in asymmetry. But there's always been a fair amount of asymmetry. That's why your download speed has always been 10 times what your upload speed is, or 5 times anyway. So asymmetry is part of the internet anyway. But yet I hear from certain bloggers and certain people that when you run a server, when you go to a peering point, that the provider of that service or that space is very concerned with, they want you to have symmetrical amounts of data. So I, that's a little piece of the puzzle that I certainly don't get.
Well, I think part of it is the asymmetry is a result of the technologies in order to squeeze the bandwidth into what you got to do. If you look at the way DSL works, DOCSIS 3.0, and a few other services, they have to do asymmetry to some degree in order to make it work. Otherwise, it just doesn't. It's. I mean, that's in its simplest terms.
Yeah.
Right, but at the peering points, I'm not sure. Yeah, the peering points could be a whole different thing.
Yeah. Hey, gosh, we spent a bunch of time on this, and I'm sure we'll spend more on it as we see how things start to shake out. All right, promise of this episode was talk about the value of maintenance, and you know, on its surface, that sounds like a kind of a subject, but it ain't. Because, you know, do you want to waste money or do you want to save money? And it's just amazing at how much money you can waste if you don't think about, some basic stuff as you go on. I mean, what would happen at your own home if you never changed the air filter, right? What would happen in your dryer, your clothes dryer, if you don't clean the lint out of it? Too many people have found out that it means a fire. It means your clothes not getting dry. It means your clothes taking way too long to get dry. And so a simple piece of maintenance is to pull that lint screen out and clean the lint out of it when you dry your clothes, right? Believe me, I've referenced to so many people that don't do that. Oh, gee. Kirk, my dryer's not working now. While you're here, can you have a look at it? Yeah, sure, I'll look at it. Pull it open, the lint, it's clogged. Well, same thing for transmitter sites and other interesting sites. I see, Chris, you're even talking about rooftops and things like that. So why don't you carry us through some of the most important things that you come across where the value of maintenance is just obvious, but maybe it's not obvious to everybody. What you got for us?
Okay, well, let's start off with something really simple. As you pointed out, filters on the transmitter. Well, ever consider where the dirt comes from? Now, I recently had a transmitter site that was not very well maintained as far as the floor dirt and other things like that. And as a result, as the air was being drawn into the transmitters, guess where it went? To the filters. But because the person was understaffed, because there was only him and one other person for engineering for three sites, they didn't get out there very often. That posed a problem. So one of the things you always consider at your site is keeping the place organized and clean. Another thing I discovered in my travels and over the years working at facilities, tools. How many times do you go to a transmitter site and the tools are either in a cardboard box, spread out on a table, or not well organized? Now, at first it may seem like, well, it's a big deal. Well, here's the big deal. 2 o'clock in the morning, you're at the transmitter site, you're trying to fix a problem, you're off the air. But because you haven't organized the tools and test gear to some degree, you're now spending time looking for stuff. Add that up. I worked at a site recently, well, last year, November, where that tools and test gear were not to be found easily. And we actually spent an extra hour trying to find stuff. By the time we were done, we're like, wow, it took us longer than we thought it should. We spent most of the time trying to find the tools.
Oh.
So these are, I mean, as you pointed out, you know, oh, this is nothing really big, but it's little stuff like that that adds up. And before you know it, you know, if you have a short window to work with, because maybe you're in a major market and being off the air is not something, you know, not an option, or you're in a smaller market where you can tolerate off the air overnight and you can get by, you still shouldn't just assume that's okay. Something else to consider. If you have a bathroom on the site, try to keep it organized and clean. I was at a site also last year that didn't bother to do that. So I decided to use the outside outhouse, which is basically out in the woods by a birch tree. These are little things, but they actually are very important, because at 2 o'clock in the morning on any day of the week, or even during the day, during the week, these are things that help you get through your day troubleshooting. And what we all know, when you're troubleshooting, it's all about focus. It's about what is the problem, going through step by step. If you're distracted by finding a tool, test gear, bathrooms you can't use, or doors that don't open properly, and you have to prop them open, find something to keep it open for you so you don't get locked out. These things take you away from one word, concentration. Mm. Very important to consider. So those are things to think about. I know it may not seem like much, but trust me, I know recently I can say it's burned me 5 times because the people I was working with did not do this kind of stuff. I've done it in the past, and I know it pays off, so it's definitely worth it. The other thing to look at your transmitter sites and even at your studio, something we overlook a lot are the outdoor elements. Say at the studio, you have STLs, wireless STLs, or even wired stuff. You have a Rhone 45 or Rhone 25 tower section on the rooftop for antennas. Maybe it's an AM loop. Maybe it's an FM Yagi. Maybe it's a scanner antenna for local police law enforcement stuff. check the cables, check paint if you have to paint it for any local zoning reasons. Matter of fact, if our studio producer would be so kind, there's a JPEG that's labeled bad ground wire tower base. If you could bring that up. So I could show you, this is a rooftop of a studio rooftop of a STL antenna section. Mm-hmm. That's the ground wire that's supposed to protect the tower section, about 40 feet, from, as we know, lightning and other things. It's not connected to anything.
No, it's just bare, right, and just laying there.
Right. And the reason I'm at that location is because a recent storm rolled through and they were off the air and they couldn't figure out what happened. And we discovered that because the tower wasn't properly grounded, they took a hit. You know, not a direct hit, but just enough static discharge on the tower that it burned a hole in the transmission line.
Now, on the rooftop there, are there places that this tower could have been grounded to?
Yes. Actually, that ground wire was connected. It just broke somewhere along the rooftop.
Okay.
And here we go back to, hey, you know, I don't do anything with my car until the light comes on and I wait another 6 months and then do something about the car having a problem. Radio station decides only one person for engineering because we don't need two. So we tend to, out of sight, out of mind, forget about the one place that really needs to at least see somebody twice a month. You know, if you could do it once a week, that's great, but at least twice a month. And you should have a checklist, have a clipboard, a book, a tablet, whatever you want to do. Just have a checklist. So when you get out there, you go through the list. So this way you can catch these things. And I went with the engineer who is a contract guy. He's a contract engineer for the site. He's like, look, I only get out here if I'm lucky once every 2 or 3 months. I don't know, you know, what to tell people. And that's the result. Now, the job we did cost them $5,000. Yeah. $5,000 because the ground wire wasn't observed on a visit.
Yeah.
You know, do the math. I mean, you're an owner of radio stations, so you understand. Yeah. So you know, you're like, wait a minute. If you had an engineer come to you and say, hey, mm-hmm, boss, we got a problem with the site and it's going to cost us 10 grand. You're like, what? Well, how did that happen? Well, since you don't let me go out to the transmitter site on a regular basis because of X, Y, and Z, I couldn't catch the fact that last two storms that rolled through ripped the wire out of the ground. Mm-hmm. And it actually happened to me many years ago back in 1992, I think it was. One of our AM towers.
Even as a station owner, I suffer from the same, I and my partners in the station suffer from the same problem. Out of sight, out of mind. We've got to get the satellite receiver hooked up for the ball game. I'm going to be at my stations for 3 days. Here's what has to get done. Dot da 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 da. Oh yeah, we never did ground that STL coax coming down off the tower, and the tower was only grounded when it was brand new with a couple of spindly little number 10 wires that go to a little ground rod. In other words, it's not very adequately grounded. And we put that off and put it off and put it off until lightning strikes and blow something up. So it's not just if I were a perfect owner and time were unlimited, then sure, this would be taken care of. But I've got equipment myself that isn't grounded as well as common good best practices would dictate. And my point in all that is it's you know, all of us have 24 hours in a day, and we have to at some point prioritize. Okay, this is important. We've got to make a trip to the transmitter site, to the rooftop, to behind the building, and buy the materials and do this job. Because if we don't intentionally do it, it's not going to do itself.
Right, but you're at least in your situation, you know, because you're a one man band for the engineering, so to speak, that you have to prioritize and go, okay, we're not going to make it out to the site. We know we have a thing we haven't finished, so be it. But there are plenty of other places where they have actual staff members who don't get to go out there and. I'm just saying this, that, you know, to protect yourself, you should, you know, find a way to talk to the management, whatever you want to call it, of the radio station facility and say, look, we need to get out here at least once or twice and put in writing and say, look, if we don't do this, here's what could possibly happen. But if you're on contract, that's a whole different story. I get that. That's part of, you know, you just go out, you say, hey, I was doing a contract job last month. I was called out to cover somebody who was going on vacation. They say, can you cover for our guy while he's away? And I said, yeah, sure. Let me go out to the site with him, walk through everything, make sure I have all the proper notes. While we were out there, and again, he couldn't get out there on a regular basis, so for the last 6 months, the site sort of got, you know, was looked at. I discovered two things at the towers, at the base of the tower, and we're like, whoa. And if we hadn't gone out there, odds are they would have been off the air within a week or two because of the issue at hand. Yeah. So it's like, yeah. I know it's not easy, but... Boy, oh boy, I tell you, if you don't try and figure out a way to work it into your schedule at least once a month, then it's just going to be a mess.
Chris, I want to pause and remind folks that you're listening to or watching This Week in Radio Tech. It's our 245th episode. We talked a bit about net neutrality, but we're also talking about the value of maintenance. Coming up after the next break, we're going to talk to, I had a chance to talk to Kevin Kidd. Kevin is a longtime engineer from Tennessee, and he is an absolute expert at this very subject of grounding. He does AM ground systems, and he also does protection, lightning-type grounding. And he's really become an expert at transmitter site security and how to keep your copper from getting ripped off by meth heads. At least how to secure it pretty well. So the interview with Kevin Kidd is coming up in just a few minutes. Tell you what, Chris, let's hit one more subject here in your list, and then we're going to have to take a break and hear from Kevin. What's the next most important thing you want to mention?
Okay, next important thing, something that people overlook, if you're at a shared site, if our illustrious producer would bring up the shared site info placard JPEG, shared sites where you could be several stations at a location sharing a tower or whatever. The one thing I've run into on many occasions, and I got a couple of calls from people about this, is posting notifications. Say, hey, this is whose equipment this is. This is what's going on. Here's the phone numbers to call. Here's the people to contact, blah, blah, blah. Something to really consider and make sure you have that info. Also, at the outside of your transmitter. I talked to a guy a couple of months ago who had a fire at his transmitter site. Nobody knew who to call. Thank goodness the trees at the fence line, the fence kept the trees from getting to the building. But now they have metal placards up that actually say, in the event of an emergency, call this number or whatever. Little things like that, just as you pointed out earlier, the simple stuff that, who knows? These are the things that you can get burned with. So shared sites, or if not a shared site, posting information as to what in the event of emergencies, things of that sort. If you have multiple towers, label the towers so that when you send somebody out to check on it, they know which tower you're talking about.
Great idea. Great idea. At our radio stations, we've got to go do this. We've just got to get take a Brother P-Touch and label the equipment. I mean, you or I know what an STL transmitter looks like, but the morning man doesn't. And it's the gray box with the meter on it. That doesn't help much.
But it's true. It's true.
But none of the sites that I take care of are multi-tenant sites, but that's really common in a lot of markets. And knowing who your neighbors are and how to reach them, that's not only courtesy to your neighbors, but also could be good for you. What if one of your other tenants, friends, cohabitants discover something that you need to know about? Make it easy for them to tell you.
Yeah, it's true.
Good point. I hadn't thought of that at all. That's a really good point. And just the tower registration number isn't enough. Nobody's going to go write that long number down and go look up in the database and find out who owns the tower or something. And anyway, you may not be an owner. You may be just another tenant there. But to make it easy for somebody to reach you, good idea.
They did have the tower registration placard on the fence, though. They did have that. Sure. But unfortunately, like you say, nobody knows what to do with it.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thanks, Chris. And we got a lot more of those subjects to cover. I think we'll cover more of these as time goes on. Mark off the things we've talked about, and we'll keep on the others. Hey, This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by the folks at Telos, and a really cool, convenient, I call it cheap and cheerful, multi-line phone system. It's the Telos HX6. It's a six-line phone system. Now for 20 years, Telos made the Telos 1X6. That was one hybrid and six phone lines, and those phone systems are everywhere. Well, it was an old design. Telos was able to improve it a lot. We have two, not one now, but two telephone hybrids. That's the actual electronics and software that turns a caller's voice into the best possible audio that it can be on the phone. And another job of the hybrid, what does a hybrid do? Well, it passes the caller's voice to you, and then when your voice as the announcer, when your voice goes toward the caller, the whole idea there is to keep it from reflecting back into the same input on your audio console that the caller's voice is at. In other words, you want a great deal of separation
between the send audio and the receive audio. Well, the hybrids that are in the Telos HX6 are Telos fifth generation design hybrids. Man, have they learned a lot. And one of the things that's significant that's in the Telos HX6 hybrids are what we call a longer series of taps, so more time. And so therefore, it's great for echo cancellation and better hybrid performance when you are talking to callers who are on cell phones or callers who are on a voice over IP phone. Those are digital systems, and they tend to have more delay because of all the stuff that has to happen to make it happen as opposed to an analog phone call. So it's important to have a longer hybrid tail to take care of those echo cancellations. Well, the Telos HX6, like other high-end Telos hybrids, also has dynamic digital EQ. This means the bass and the high end are automatically EQ'd to try to give you the most consistent call-to-call-to-call sound. There are other really interesting tricks that the Telos hybrids play. For example, one of them is a pitch shifter. When the Telos hybrid sends audio from the radio station to the caller, it actually shifts the pitch of that audio down just a bit. This is to help eliminate feedback buildup. So if you have open mic and open speaker, well, this little technique that Steve Church at Telos developed, this can help eliminate, break that cycle of feedback buildup. So you can do a television show, for example, with the Telos HX6 hybrid and get a lot more gain before you'd have any feedback. The HX6, six POTS phone lines, and two telephone hybrids. So if you want to do conferencing between two callers, works great. It works perfectly. The HX6 can also combine both hybrids outputs into one audio output. So if you want to, you can just use one fader on your console, or you can have it split with two faders on the console. It's got even got a mode that'll do built-in conferencing. So if your audio console only can provide one mix minus output to the callers, well, the Telos HX6 will take care of letting the other caller hear the first caller and vice versa, and we'll just take care of all that for you. So you can run it either way with two mix minuses or one. Hey, if I'm speaking a little bit, you know, over the top here, no problem. Get the brochure, go to the Telos website, and look at the Telos HX6 telephone hybrid. Oh, and by the way, if you already have an Axia console, you don't need the HX6. Get the IQ6 and save yourself a few $100s. The IQ6 doesn't have any XLR connectors on it for audio. It only has a live wire connector. But if you've got an Axia console, that's all you need. Check them out if you would. Go to telos-systems.com and then click on the Telos button for on-air phone systems, and you'll find the Telos HX6. All right, this is episode 245 of This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Tobin is with me, but Chris and I are going to kick up our heels for a minute and sit back and relax and watch what my friend Kevin Kidd has to say. I got to talk to Kevin just today. Kevin came to the SBE meeting in Nashville and talked about site security, and man, was it a good presentation. We learned a lot, and then I got to talk to Kevin for a few minutes afterwards. So, Andrew, if you're ready, let's hear from Kevin Kidd.
So we're talking with Kevin Kidd. He's the proprietor at AM Ground Systems Company, and is it KK Engineering?
KK Broadcast Engineering.
Broadcast Engineering, that's right. We don't want to get you involved in other kinds of engineering.
No.
So we're talking about the value of maintenance. And Kevin, I know, man, a lot of people end up having to call you and your company a lot later than they should have called you.
Yes.
So I'm sure that on the one hand, you enjoy being needed. There's probably preventive things that transmitter site owners can do, whether they're AM or FM or multi-use, that would help them from having to call you on an emergency basis. So what's your top advice that you give to a tower site owner so that he doesn't have to call you on an emergency basis?
Well, actually, for somebody other than me to know where the transmitter site is at is probably one of the number one things I run into.
That's a problem?
Oh, yes.
Wow. Wow.
I have made emergency calls to stations that they had to go find the transmitter site themselves, and then they had to find the keys for it. I went to a station, won't mention where, but that was off the air for no other reason than a breaker was tripped in the building.
Wow.
Except they didn't have a key to the building, and they needed a thief. I managed to get the transmitter door open without a key, which most engineers know how to do such things.
Yeah.
And reached in, never entered the building. Reached around, flipped the breaker back on, transmitter came on, looked over and checked the readings, and
done.
Thank you.
Wow. Well, that sounds, I mean, my goodness, you notice my surprise. That sounds so basic that a station owner wouldn't know where a key was. Absolutely. Or even maybe not even where the site
but
is.
In this instance, the station owner was out of town.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So he would have had a key, but yeah, nobody else. I recommend that you keep numerous sets of keys, complete sets of keys, for transmitter sites and the studio as well. There should be a set, like with the program director, the owner should have a set. There should be a set that is accessible somewhere in the studio building.
Yeah.
Hanging, and it doesn't have to be identified. You don't have to have a big tag on it that says transmitter keys.
Right.
But it should have a great big purple number one or something on it. So if you have to tell somebody where the keys are at, you can say go to the men's bathroom and get the set of keys with the big number one on it.
Now, speaking of getting to the, at the transmitter site itself, you just gave us a talk here at the SBE meeting about security items. What are the top two or three things that you think site owners ought to make sure are taken care of?
Well, like I said in the presentation, somebody paying attention to what's going on at the site is the number one thing. The site should be kept fairly clean. Of course, the building filters need to be cleaned in buildings and so forth. But as far as outside the building, making the place look lived in.
Oh, okay. Part of your presentation was about not giving potential thieves a place to hide. Now, by the way, I guess we should point out a lot of the thievery that goes on is copper theft, isn't
it?
Yes. To trade it in for money and go buy drugs or whatever somebody might need. So copper is a convenient way to convey some money from one place to another. Take it from
Absolutely.
One person and
it's a new goal.
Yeah. You mentioned don't give thieves a place to hide where their activities couldn't be seen.
All right. Make sure all lighting is working. And make sure that the fences aren't overgrown. Make sure that, of course, there's a lot of transmitter sites where there's not another living soul within 20 miles.
But
if there's a road close by, keep things clean to where you can actually see the transmitter site from the road. Sometimes that's a double-edged sword. Sometimes it's maybe better to not be able to see the site.
I see.
However, it's kind of hard to hide a 200 or 300 or 500 foot tower. So actually having it to where somebody might be seen by a passerby is very useful. But keep the site clean. Keep the fences cleaned out is one of the biggest things to discourage vandalism that there is. Period.
I think you also mentioned look for signs of people spending time there that shouldn't be. Maybe Coke cans or McDonald's wrappers or other things that you might find out in the woods.
There's our tire tracks.
Okay.
Somebody should go to the tower site several times a week, if possible, at least once a week. Vandalism that is found later is almost never solved. We've worked on sites that have literally been probably months since anybody had been there.
So checking the site at least a couple times a week, and that doesn't have to be a technical person just to stop by and have a look.
No. A technical person needs to have a look regularly.
Yeah.
But a non-technical person can drive into the site and see if the gate's laying on the ground or if the lights are knocked out or if the fence is cut through or the doors are hanging open on the building or there's been digging around the towers. Anybody can drive through and do that. Even had some stations have an intern go out a couple times a week.
But you brought up a good point there. You make sure the lights are working, but also it sounds like you kind of need to stop by sometimes during the day and sometimes at night. Now, you mentioned lights as if you assumed people had them. I'm thinking of tower sites that aren't very well lighted. What do you recommend?
Well, first off, need to be completely lit. Mm-hmm. And I highly recommend dusk to dawn lighting with the current monitoring.
Oh, you mean as opposed to motion-sensed lighting?
Yes.
Okay.
Motion-sensed lighting, if that's all you can have or that's all you can afford, do it. Better than nothing. Mm-hmm. But that's for sure you need to keep a closer eye physically on the lights, mm-hmm. because there is no way, there's no reliable way to monitor and remotely monitor a motion light, because, well, if there's no motion, it's usually off.
Yeah, but you're saying a dusk to dawn light, you could measure the current or give yourself a remote indication that the light's on, the light's off. And if it's 2 a.m. and the light's not on, maybe you ought to have the remote control give you a call.
Yes. And having a light go out, if you have a good lighting system and the area is well lit and you have a light go off, that's not necessarily reason for mass panic.
Right.
But if you see a light go off on your remote control, mm-hmm. and it lets you know, 10 or 15 minutes later, another light goes off. 10 or 15 minutes later, the door alarm goes off. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
They're here.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's a good
but
point.
But all of the sites that, practically all of the sites that I have worked on, I can't honestly recall a single site that has had working lights that the lights weren't somehow compromised. Most of the time, they knock them out.
Okay, so if a site is vandalized or theft occurs, you're saying that in almost every case, lights are knocked out.
Right. And normally, they're physically broken.
I see.
So if you're monitoring the current on those lights, mm-hmm. and that light's broken out, the current and an alarm should go off.
But for engineers that don't know, you could have the same photocell that turns the lights on at dusk activate the ability of your remote control system to monitor them.
There's any number of ways to do it, not necessarily any. One of the better things that I have come across is a sidereal timer.
Oh.
They're used for turning on in place of a photocell.
Okay.
Especially in areas where there's it can be cloudy. This sidereal timer, you generally, it's just a microprocessor, you put your, usually your zip code.
Okay,
in,
okay.
And you tell it then whether you want it to be at sunrise, what parameters you want. Do you want sunset to sunrise, 1 hour after? On for 2 hours, off the rest of the night, back on. And you don't really, most thefts that we have come across have not occurred immediately after sunset.
Mm.
Most of them occur in the wee hours of the morning.
Really? Like 1, 2, 3?
1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, really?
So you could actually have a timer on it and be reasonably safe to enable the current sensors to start the alarming at whatever, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. And in the wintertime, if you didn't want to set it, you would still be, it'd be dark from 4:30 until 9.
Yeah.
So that's a but you do have to disable it, because when the lights go off,
yes, and
then at dawn when the lights go off, your alarm's going to go off.
Understood. You know, something that you touched on just a little bit, but if you can put security cameras at the transmitter site, great. And a lot of engineers at this point turn their brain off because, well, we can't get internet at our transmitter site. Well, I got to tell you, we've installed some of these in at my stations in American Samoa, and we're going to be installing more at our station in Mississippi. We've got sites you can't get internet to, but you can shoot a microwave signal out there, mm-hmm. and the radios to do that are now dirt cheap, a couple hundred, $300, and you can shoot
less than 100.
Okay. And you can get some internet out to there, some network, mm-hmm. and put your cameras on that same network.
Yes.
Now, that said, there's a bit of an older style of cameras that are available that are pretty cheap. They're meant for home, and brands like Swan is one particular brand name, where they're not IP cameras, but they feed into a DVR that is IP, mm-hmm. and you can set them up for motion detection and mm-hmm. to send you an email. You don't have to sit there and watch the camera 24/7, but you can watch your email, mm-hmm. and if something comes in, well, then you can say, oh, maybe I better go have a look at my cameras. Get on your cell phone or Internet Explorer and have a look at the cameras.
UBNT, mm-hmm. Little radios, they make a and I own no stock in Ubiquiti or anything else, but they make a amazing for $89 to $110 or $120 line of radios. They'll do the 900 meg may be more expensive, but they make an amazing line of 2.4, 5.8, and even higher. That it, how they can make them that cheap and that good, it's just unbelievable.
And the point of that is you can extend your network at your radio station out to the transmitter side. You can hook up a VoIP phone, IP camera. You could even have off-site backup of your automation files out there. A lot of uses. My point is you don't have to put this link in, because you will have some expense for climbing the towers and properly grounding the Ethernet cable that goes up the tower. But once you do that, it opens up a world of possibilities, including security. Mm-hmm. For the site, you got people who are, I know I've mentioned all this. You got anybody doing that?
I've got a couple of clients that we at least temporarily, on some occasions, have. I've got several clients doing the radio to the transmitter using those.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple of clients that we have temporarily put up some cameras just to see what was going on. As a matter of fact, had a transmitter was doing some weird stuff and could never catch it doing it, so I carried one of my cameras out and sat on it and pointed it at it and found later what was wrong, but was able to actually see it when it happened.
What else makes a site attractive to a thief?
Well, anything exposed copper is, of course, you want to keep them away from the exposed copper. Mm-hmm. So, you know, gates, which is would be part and parcel defenses, but you don't want to give somebody enough room to get in and get comfortable, so the gate should be out at the road. In that, anything copper that might be exposed around above ground level is has got to be disguised one way or the other. Either you can now buy, if it's like copper bus bars, which have typically been they've always been in danger.
But these are the big bars that radio stations and cell companies, in particular,
cell companies
tie
in particular
a lot of grounding to a bar. Okay,
those have always been highly sought after, but now some of the manufacturers of those have started making them tinned. Still a copper bus bar, but it just has a tin coating.
Tin on the outside, so it looks less valuable.
It looks less valuable.
I see.
They've also started stamping almost continuously on that bus bar, stolen, do not recycle, and then some of the bigger companies have even have their name stamped all over.
Okay, okay, like AT&T okay.
One of the things that we have found quite by accident that works, seems to work very well at least, that if you have exposed copper, just a simple can of the or probably gray paint would work as well, but the cold galv stays longer. Slather, and I don't mean don't be shy about spraying it. Soak it down with it. We've had success with sites that had trouble, had been stolen, and then put new stuff in, and maybe it get gone again, and replace it, and then soak it down with copper, or contaminate it with tar.
Oh.
Gooey, black, the sticky, adhesive type tar.
Yeah, yeah.
Because first off, recyclers don't want to take it.
Right, right.
And then again, it doesn't necessarily look like copper.
I'm guessing you want to make all your solid connections first before you put the tar on.
Yeah, you'll hate life. And whoever does your laundry will hate life.
Oh, goodness. So you're talking about disguising the metal and making it look worse, or hiding it behind a wooden plank if it's a copper strap going down the side of the building? Okay.
Or, well, these days you are better off to knock a hole in the side of the building and get the strap inside the building and then grout that hole back up and make everything outside look as normal as you can.
One more question. Seems like I heard about a substance that you could put over or into your AM ground system. It was, I don't know if it was some kind of a concrete. It made it very difficult to get the radials out.
There is a product. We have not used it. And probably will be looking into it. There's two different things that have been we're looking into. One is it's conductive concrete, if that's what you're...
maybe that's it.
And it literally is a concrete mixture that has something, I don't think it's carbon, in it. And you can, normal concrete, as long as it has some moisture in it, you can measure resistance across normal
sure.
concrete.
Yeah.
But this measures, down in the, depending on which version of it you get, I think down into hundreds of ohms
okay.
over
okay.
a fairly good distance.
Okay.
And that's being tried to try actually grounding that
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and using it around tower bases to protect most of the bigger copper in AM ground systems is around the tower base.
Ah, the copper that's worth your time in,
right.
in pulling
yes.
out if
right.
you're a thief.
That's the first place most of the, when somebody gets into an AM ground system, that's the first place they usually start.
Right.
They get the strap or tubing that goes around the tower, the strap's right. coming off the tower. And if you can protect that, the other product that probably will use in the next while is one of the problems with pouring just concrete over copper at around a tower is it carries the moisture away. Moisture is needed for
okay.
it to work correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a product now that is being used in the road building trades called permeable pavement.
Okay.
And it is a concrete mixture, except it has very, very little fine aggregate in it.
Hmm.
And the rocks stick together, make a, if you can imagine, a almond patty with... lots of almonds, but not much chocolate on it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It literally is rock that water will just run through.
Okay. Okay.
That is, we're working on a project that's probably going to be used partially for to protect the concrete and partially because a designer wanted the area covered around the, because there will be some traffic around it.
If the station needs some security consulting or some actual ground system work and repair, where can folks get a hold of you?
You can find me at www.amgroundsystems.com.
Okay.
Or email me at kkidd4@kkb.com.
Or they could probably Google Kevin Kidd with two D's and AM Ground Systems.
Absolutely.
Find you right there. Kevin, thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate, your advice. Thanks.
Thank you.
And I sure enjoyed talking to Kevin Kidd. If you need him, amgroundsystems.com. And obviously does AM ground systems and other grounding and regular kinds of maintenance as well. But good guy. Hey, our show is brought to you in part, our show This Week in Radio Tech, brought to you in part by Axia and the Axia Fusion console. Hey, earlier this week, I had the chance to talk to a number of Axia dealers about some of the cool things that the Fusion console does. Now, in the last few episodes of our show, we've been actually running a little commercial, a little explainer about the Fusion that Clark Novak has done. And we'll return to that next week, but I'll just go ahead and give you a few oversights of the Fusion console. It's really been the kind of thing that the folks at Axia took so much advice, so many comments that they've heard about Axia consoles over the last 10 years, from the Smart Surface to the Element to the IQ and the Radius. And they've taken that advice and they put as much as they possibly could into a new console, the Axia Fusion. Now, a lot of the console is based on the original Element console, but there are a number of improvements, mechanical, metal, circuit design, layout. For example, instead of being a CAN bus cable between the Fusion Surface and the power supply or the power station that it might be hooked to, now it's Ethernet. And that means you can hook it up anywhere on the Axia Ethernet network that you want to. It doesn't have to be limited to, you know, being a 35 or 40 or 50-foot CAN bus cable. It's still powered by 48 volts. So there are, of course, power supplies available from Axia. There's a new Fusion power supply, and you can make it redundant. You can. We actually designed a circuit board that goes into the Fusion console that accepts up to two power supply cables coming into it. And but it converts the Ethernet then into the CAN bus that's still used inside the console itself. A couple of things about the Fusion design is that it's really gorgeous and very usable. You look at this thing and it just makes so much sense. It's so clear, and it meets the sensibilities, the design sensibilities of a lot of engineers and users. Also, above every channel strip is a new OLED display. This is organic LED. It's very sharp and crisp and bright. And it gives you some information that we couldn't previously give you. It gives you the pre-fader source level coming in. So it's got pre-fader level displayed there for confidence that, hey, there's something there. And it gives you a send level. Because the Fusion, like all the Axia consoles, can do automatic mix minus and talkback, that is, you know, IFB, interruptible foldback. You can push a talkback button, and if there's a path back to the source, you can talk to it like a guest with headphones or somebody on a telephone hybrid or somebody on an ISDN or an IP codec or somebody coming in by satellite that's dialed in to an auto answer coupler for their telephone IFB. Well, you get all that, and you can see your levels going out to that caller. Of course, an enormous array of accessories and other things. The Axia Fusion console works perfectly with every other Axia device out there and all the LiveWire enabled devices from, I think it's something like 70 different manufacturers, partners, have equipment, automation systems, hardware that plugs right into Axia's LiveWire and lets you talk. And, of course, Fusion is part of the AES-67 standard. When you connect an Axia X node to the system, you have right there the box that does the proper clocking and the proper formatting for AES-67 IP audio streams, making it compatible with anybody else who's doing AES-67. Check out the Fusion console. Hey, it's available from anywhere from, let's see, you could build a 4-fader console. You can build a 6-fader console. You can go up to a 40-fader console with Fusion. So a number of sizes, accessory modules, design layouts, almost infinite. It's literally in the tens of thousands of different consoles you can build with the Axia Fusion's layout. Also, if you want to check it out on the website, go to axiaaudio.com. And go take a look at the videos that that we sometimes show here during this commercial time with Clark Novak describing the Axia console. Thanks a lot to Axia for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Sure appreciate that. All right, Chris Tobin, you still there, buddy? Have you fallen asleep?
I'm still here. Yeah, No. Good stuff.
All right. Hey, we got more great shows coming up, a whole year of them, and I'm just delighted to have you you along with us. Hey, Chris, so if folks need some expertise from you, you do IP codecs both for radio, television. You're the expert solutionist to figure out how to get signal from here to there in this brave new world of IP. Where can folks get hold of you?
Oh, just at support@ipcodecs.com. Yeah, I've been doing more than just IP stuff and that kind of thing. I've been hanging from tower sections and building rooftops and doing antenna work.
Oh, my goodness. That's
Yeah, you didn't get to see one of the pictures that Andrew has. It's me on a ladder beneath a TV6, Channel 6, log periodic antenna on top of a building in Queens.
Oh, wow. Wow.
There it is.
Oh,
there you go.
Oh, whoa. So
part of the conversation of maintenance was outdoor wear and how to protect you, how to minimize freezing your hands and stuff. So that was the picture I was going to show.
Wow.
It was a cold day.
I don't know about you, but when I get done doing some kind of work, oh, what a view.
That's from the ladder I was on.
I find out all the muscles that I haven't used in the last 6 months. And they're sore.
Oh, trust me, I can assure you that after a couple of days worth of that kind of stuff, I do feel those muscles. I'm like, wow, I didn't know that existed. Wow. But it's good. It's fun. It keeps you on your toes, and it makes you think about stuff in a very different way. So I enjoy it.
Well, Chris, thanks for being with us. We didn't get through our whole value of maintenance list, which just means that we'll have some plenty more fodder for our next show when we don't have a guest for the whole hour. So stay tuned for more of Chris's tips on how to take care of stuff and the value of maintenance. And we're going to go. Hey, thanks to Andrew Zarian for being the producer on This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks to our sponsors, Lavo with the touchscreen console, also Telos and the HX6, and the folks at Axia with the new beautiful Fusion console now shipping. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.